Comrades, I have read that in China, a child's first birthday is celebrated when he or she is born. He, she is then deemed to be 1 year old. And when you think about it, it is fairly logical. It's a rough approximation to the period of gestation, which is, after all, a very important part of our lives, even though we don't remember it. However that may be, it is certainly the case that to understand the evolution of the socialist view group, you have to look at where it came from. Because it is not true that we, or perhaps I should say Kirk, because he was the theoretician of the group, rose like Aphrodite from the waves, full of forms and all these precious ideas and so on. It is not true at all. We came out of the then British Trotskyist organisation, which was called the RCP, the Revolutionary Communist Party. This was an organisation of no great size. The maximum claim it ever made for membership was 400, and I know that that's a phony. In fact, probably 300 at the maximum, and the period we're talking about going down. That's important. We'll see why in a moment. But secondly, it was an activist organisation. Unlike its, some of its immediate predecessors in Britain, who, for a variety of reasons, had become obsessed with the Labour Party, with anarchist activity, with revolution passing, and so on and so forth, the activity of the RCC was modelled on a miniature scale, if you like, of what they imagined the Communist Party had been in its revolutionary period. That is to say, its orientation was fundamentally on the working class, not on its institutions primarily, on industrial struggles, secondarily on the unions. Now, that was important because those of us who came into the Socialist Review group, and my God, we were pretty thin on the ground, and pretty ignorant, and all the rest of it, nevertheless had been brought up in that tradition. That was to be a very important factor, even in the period, which Colin Barker will talk about tomorrow, I think, when intervention was in reality impossible. We had been formed in that mould. But we had also been formed in the mould of what it is usual to call Orthodox Trotskyism. I'm not entirely happy about the term, but using it in the sense that people like Alex Kalinikov uses it. That is to say, our political education, such as it was, and our world outlook was that of the 1938 Trotsky's 1938 program, and so on. We came from an organization which confidently predicted, like all the others, and firmly believed, that the period after the Second World War would be a period of revolutionary upheaval, and that was right, as a matter of fact, but also a period in which both Stalinism and social democracy would more or less rapidly disintegrate. Now, more or less can mean a period of years, of course, but that basically we had the notion that it was impossible for the reformist organisations, although they could be going, to play the role that they had played in the 30s, in the 20s, leading to a series of devastating defeats. Now, hindsight, great wisdom, isn't it? You look back and you say, they must have been back. After all, this was the period in Europe, and after all, we were in Europe, the whole movement, for reasons I'll take up if someone wants to accuse me of being Eurocentric, was essentially European plus North American. In Europe, this was precisely the period in which the Communist parties in particular experienced massive growth. The French Communist Party, a minority party in the working class before the war, even at the height of the Popular Front period, emerged as the majority party of the French working class. Similarly in Italy, similarly in Greece, and Communist parties everywhere, even in peaceful little Denmark, actually experienced rapid and considerable growth. The Danish CP was actually in the government in the immediate post-war period, and so on and so forth. Social democracy also experienced a massive growth. The British Labour Party, at that time,
yes,
zero stir rocket party, was not only elected and in power in 1945, it was growing as an organisation. It had between 4 or 5 times the paper membership it now claims to have, right? And its number of activists, assuming it was a fairly close population, actually I suspect the number of activists has gone down and grew dramatically in the membership, was very considerable. Now this presented a certain problem. Initially, it's an advertising. It's a temporary phenomenon. Right? Why did they have the view then in the first place? Why actually did we suppose, I say we, all the top groups, suppose that social democracy and Stalinism were basically finished? Well, over a period of not too long a number of years. Not, of course, because we thought our ideas are superior. That's inferior, therefore we will win. Rubbish! Trotsky's ideas have been immensely superior in the 20s and 30s. We haven't won. No, for two reasons. First of all, because in terms of social democracy primarily, but also the Stalinists, there was an analysis which derived from Trotsky's 1938 writings and subsequently that in the immediate post-war period and after, capitalism would be thrown into a most profound crisis. That normality, a return to even the sort of precarious normality that existed in 1938-39, was excluded. Now, again, hindsight is very easy. And if you think all these people were nuts, actually, if you looked around, not in Britain, if you looked around most of Europe, actually the conditions predicted stagnation, industrial decline, decay existed in 46, 47. Ceasing to exist in 48, by the way, but they did exist. The German industry, which had been the, because it had sucked into itself, you know, some sense of it colonized in a sense European industry as a whole, was ruined. It wasn't a question of unemployment, it was massive. It was a question, actually, of a combination of mass unemployment and general scarcity, and so on and so forth. But in a superficial view, that perspective seems to be right. Secondly, there was the view that, again, derived from Trotsky's writings, late last writings, writings of the late 30s and early 40s, that the society that existed in the USSR, he called it a degenerated worker state, but I don't want to argue about the label. The important thing is the analysis, which nobody holds today, by the way. Well, some people hold the label. The analysis was as follows. This is a society of extreme social tension, which has not long to live. Trotsky had written in 1940, shortly before his death, about this society, its lifetime would probably be a few years or even a few months. Now again, we look, what is it, 60 years afterwards? Say, my God. Again, there was apparently evidence for Trotsky's view, reinforced by an analysis. That analysis was, what is the source of the power of the bureaucracy? Said they're not a class, they have no real roots in the productive process, they're essentially a parasitic caste. How do they exist? They exist because the great forces in society are more or less evenly balanced. These forces, on Trotsky's analysis, were, on the one hand, working class, in this case the working class of the USSR, seen as constantly struggling to overthrow the bureaucratic caste and so on, and on the other side, the forces which he called the forces of capitalist restoration. I don't want to criticize this, but I want to explain it. Anyone who has any doubts that this was the analysis should read Trotsky's last writings. It's not something that, you know, we concocted. This was the view. Now then, if you have a society in which there are two major forces basically locked into constant pressure one against the other and so on, and you have an excrescence, not a bourgeois class, right, it's in Britain or anything, but something with no roots in production, no roots fundamentally in society, balancing on the top. It can balance, Trotsky called it a sphere poised on the point of a pyramid. Now, that, I assure you, is not a very stable space of that. And down it goes, one way or the other. In other words, as soon as the relationship of forces shifts one way or the other, the working class becomes stronger and more militant, all the restorationist forces get the upper hand, the regime must go. It is a historical aberration and cannot survive. And therefore, because Trotsky was interested in what was going to happen in Europe, first of all, right? Therefore the mass Stalinist parties must, as the regime goes down, splinter, fragment. There will be reformist tendencies, there will be semi-revolutionary tendencies, and so on and so forth. And it was on the basis of this sort of perspective that the Trotskyist groups believed that they, weak, of the human weak, I mean human aside from idiots, human very weak, shallow roots and so on, could hope to become integrated with big revolutionary currents in the short term. Hence the perspective. Now then, that applied around to all the top groups. There weren't so many on the internet. I now want to turn to the reaction from that was led, not by the originators of the Socialist Tribune, although all of us, without exception, adhered to the majority leadership of the RCC, who did our thinking for us, actually, at an early stage, they began to question, not the question of Stalinism in the first instance, but the question of the economic perspective. Said, you know, actually, there is no reason why there should not be a revival of the capitalist economy. In Europe, why? They didn't distinguish between East and West at that stage, the reason I'll come to in a moment. Why? That's the nature of the crisis. Crisis of overproduction. You must be joking. You must be joking. I mean, in Germany, that part of the population is near starvation. In Britain, even bread was still rationed, you know. Overproduction? Ludicrous. Massive destruction of industry, destruction of existing capitals, and so on and so forth. So is it the case that the organic composition of capital is an excellent in the upwards and therefore the pressure on the property? You must be joking. The opposite has happened. There has been a massive writing out of capital. This was the argument made by people like Hast and Grant and so on. And therefore, as a short-term perspective, it won't do. Now, it is important to understand the qualifications. Nobody thought at that time, as a matter of fact, very few people on the left, that what was in prospect was a prolonged and sustained capitalist boom lasting decades. What was envisaged was a 1919, 1920 to mid-1921 situation in which Europe and North America was a sharp economic revival. There was a boom, the post-war boom. There would be a boom. Now, why the hell does that matter? Why are we interested in economic analysis? After all, we are not professional economists and so on. Because, of course, anti-Marxists who call themselves Marxists say this is reductionism. There is, of course, a connection between the radicalization and non-radicalization of millions, and whether or not they are not doing badly, thank you, or whether they feel desperate and ground down. Now, I don't mean to suggest there's a simple automatic correlation, but that is a connection. If there isn't, Marxism is nonsense. It therefore follows that, far from disintegrating in the short run, Reformism, Stalinism, would have a second or third or whatever it is lease of life. And therefore, it follows patient work, a way of revolutionary rhetoric and so on and so forth. In particular, there was one very sharp dispute connected with this about the nature of the post-war regimes in Europe. I repeat, they did not distinguish between East and West. Nobody did at that time. Not included. Because everyone took it for granted that East European regimes would remain fundamentally capitalist regimes, you see. It was this. Bourgeois democracy is a form of capitalist class rule adapted to circumstances in which, on the one hand, there is not prolonged catastrophic decline of the economy, that will finish it, and on the other hand, there are powerful working class organizations. CP leaders argue both these conditions exist, or rather the second exists and the first will exist, and sure enough when the Marshall Plan came around it did. Now, this was our first and in many ways most important break, as they asked all our CP majority, including even dear old Ted Grant and the pioneers of the militant group, our first decisive break with the phrase-mongering of post-war Trotskyism, because they insisted, led by the American SWP and its European acolytes, they had a thing called the International Secretariat. Three men really in Paris, three men and a dog in Paris. This is revisionism. This is, as Cannon said, revising our program. Confusing. The program, you know, very thoughtful, with your analysis of the current situation. And we were treated to a series of arguments, and the venom was quite astonishing to me. It wasn't so to Aston, but remember, I'm young, inexperienced, and so on and so forth. My hair was quite light at the time, but not grey. The venom of this, you see, they were ready to a perspective, because then the notion of perspective and program were completely rolling together. We were told their writer was a talented young man. I mean, their main writer, called Ernest Mandel. He called himself Germain at the time. I quote, I don't want to polemicize particularly, but so this is in 1946, this is not Mandel's personal opinion, if you understand. This was the received view, and all attempts to amend it were systematically voted down. There is no reason whatever, he goes in 1946, to assume that we are facing a new epoch of capitalist stabilization and development. Incidentally, that was sleight of hand, because the RCP were not arguing we're facing a new epoch, but arguing that in the next few years there will be an economic revival, which is slightly different, but never mind. On the contrary, the war has acted only to aggravate the disproportion between the increased productivity of the capitalist economy and the capacity of the world market to absorb it. This was nonsense, but never mind, this was their position. And it followed, and this again, this is their 45 work, this means that because of the economic war, it says, the experience of the countries liberated, in quotes, by the Red Army, as in those liberated, in quotes, by the Allied Army, demonstrates conclusively that the bourgeoisie, really, incapable of making the smallest concession to the masses, remember the NHS in Britain, incapable of making the smallest concession to the masses, turns from the beginning to strong solutions to peace and military dictatorships. An intermediate, democratic, in quotes, period, lasting until the decisive victory either of the socialist revolution or once again of fascism, and I quote, word for word, will be impossible. Now, I suppose that in many ways, apart from the fact that they had already history of previous distance, one of the facts that made the British RCP leadership realise from the beginning that this is Cosworth, was the fact that they lived in Britain. Because, for a variety of reasons, far from stagnating, the British economy began to grow quite rapidly in the immediate post-war period. Now we have, therefore, these bitter arguments. The important thing about the arguments was this. On our side, there was an attempt, an inadequate attempt, let's be quite clear about it, but an attempt to analyse the actual situation. You know, to adopt Trotsky's slogan, first thing for revolutionaries is to look reality in the face. Because, of course, we would have looked to third catastrophe, obviously. on their side, the sacred text. It says this, 38, therefore it must be so. Now, the really deadly thing about that sort of thing is not only that you may give it to yourselves in short term, but that you then become completely disoriented. Once you realize, once the fact finally hit you, you spin like cops all over the place. Now, why then did the British RCP leadership, oh, we're talking about 250 perhaps people, led by a handful of people, Hafton, Grant, Tears, and luckily, a bright young intellectual they had acquired called Tony Twist. I should have mentioned the RCP, well, the question of the time in the educational system, didn't have any intellectuals other than Twist, and by intellectual, I mean someone who could read the language other than English. I mean, literally true, you know, I mean, we have nobody with a higher education or anything like that, so Tony Twist is very valuable asset indeed. He became very rapidly, the erudition of the group. Why doesn't this group then, as a group, develop and become the Socialist Appeal Group it would have been, if that was the name of our paper? If it had, we would be much stronger today, no question about it. Because there is no doubt that Hafton, particularly, was one of the most capable people there has ever been in the revolutionary movement in Britain in the 20th century. Absolutely beyond any question whatever. But Tears was a first-class industrial organizer. Well, with a vast amount of experience and so on and so forth. It was quite an impressive little team. Actually, it fell apart. Why did it fall apart? One theoretical reason above all, and secondly a practical one. And that second theoretical reason brings you to the point at which the RCP majority, I keep talking about majorities, there was a minority of true believers, supported, of course, by the international so-called, i.e. by the Paris Bureau, and above all by the American SWP, led by a man called Jerry Healy, who we may have heard of. They simply reproduced the arguments that were written by Mandel and followed the line laid down by Collins. The majority, however, disintegrated. 47, 48, 49, they collapsed. Because of the other great problem, the problem of Stalinism. Now, that the USSR, the regime in the USSR had not collapsed was not in itself disastrous, because you can always say that next year, or the year after, if you cautious, rightly, or next month, or the month after, if you are more, you know, enthusiastic, you can always, you know, for a while, not forever. But there was this terrible problem of Eastern Europe. Because once devastating problem from a theoretical point of view for the Trotskyists, because first, the Russian army had occupied most of Eastern Europe, and some important parts of Eastern Europe, Yugoslavia and Albania, had actually, communist parties had come to power. I don't mean office, I don't mean they were sitting in the cabinet, as they were in France, in Italy, in Denmark, in the Netherlands, and so on. I mean to power. The state machines, which had been essentially German puppet regimes previously, had been replaced by state machines which the communist parties, or at least their Russian masters, control, all the indigenous ones, and as in the case of Yugoslavia. Okay? That seemed to present no problems. According to Mandel, no problems. It's a form of bonapartism. More of a bonapartism, you see. But then, unfortunately, from this point of view, as the Cold War began to get underway, particularly from the autumn of 47, a massive nationalization. Now, they were varying importance in the different countries. In Bulgaria, there wasn't much of a bourgeoisie to start with. You had to look hard to find them. And there was, of course, the capitalist class, but it was German, French, etc., etc. In Czechoslovakia, just to agree, there was very sizable bourgeoisie, and there certainly was in East Germany, etc. The bourgeoisie was expropriated. Expropriated. Their assets were taken. Massive nationalizations and so on and so forth. Okay, so why does that matter? Because of the implications for the USSR. Very briefly, by 1948, the social and political structures of the various East European countries were essentially similar to that of the USSR. Although we're forming differences, there indeed there still are. You know, there's still a Christian Democratic Party in the, what is commonly called the German Democratic Republic. Did you know that? There's also still a Free Democratic Party. And sure enough, in their rights summit, or whatever they call it now, these people have representation. Who chooses them? You know, I mean, in other words, there are puppet parties. Well, puppet parties didn't exist in the USSR for different reasons. And now some formalists, of course, wanted to make a great deal of that. But come on, never serious arguments. No. You have to face the fact that over Eastern Europe, 100 million people, about a third of the then population of Europe, had been transformed, had had their societies transformed from what everyone had known about, bourgeois societies, to, it's inescapable, isn't it? Worker states? Inescapable. Now then, it is difficult to people who didn't see Trotsky's and Fern, didn't understand the post, basically understand the nature of immediate post-Trotskyism, to realize how devastating this was. Because it had been laid down as a fundamental principle, as Trotsky said, Stalinism is counter-revolutionary. Specifically, and I quote, the force that came to play the reactionary role in Russia cannot play a revolutionary role on the world arena. And indeed, that was the justification for forming the Fourth International in the first instance, for God's sake. If they could play a revolutionary role, in however distorted and so on fashion, then the whole basis of the operation was undermined. Because, you know, you don't start with handfuls of people to challenge the big established organizations. If, you know, with puny forces, if you think there is any serious possibility that these organizations can be changed, or they can behave fundamentally differently, I hope you do, you're a sectarian nutter. Aren't you? I mean, they're not sectarian nutters in that sense. Consequently, the effect of the East European debate was to produce a series of crises, and I'll talk now about the crisis in the British section. At an early stage, by 47, Haskell and Co. had decided, you know, there is no fundamental difference between Poland, I will take Poland simply as an example, and the USSR. Therefore, under Poland is a worker state, however distorted, degenerated, deformed, or whatever term you care to invent, or the USSR is not. You know, it is impossible to maintain the two positions, it was said. That was wrong. There could be. It is impossible if you have any logical coherence and serious pretensions to analysis. Well then, this originally led Haskell and Co. to think, you know, there hasn't been a proletarian revolution in Poland. That's absolutely right. As Mandel writes, I don't want to bore you with a lot of quotations, what I'm giving the first instance of fresh revolutionary movements in Eastern Europe. Absolutely true. Read Chris Brooks, Stalin's satellites in Europe and so on. Established authoritarian despotic regime. Absolutely true. But also carried out, what if for you the key criterion is nationalisation of the bulk of the means of production as a social transformation? Therefore, they looked and said, you know, maybe we were wrong about Russia after all. Maybe it is state capitalism. And they toyed with the idea. There was an international argument, of course. They toyed with it. Haskell wrote an article in which he emphasized, it was published and circulated in the various groups, in which he emphasized certain features of the Russian economy, which were intended to be, you know, argued did not exist. Money, market forces, wage labor, yes. Doesn't that mean capital? Yes. But not actually drawing the conclusions. They toyed with the idea and then they recoiled. Now, at an early stage, they sought the assistance of someone who could actually read Russian and so on. His name was Cliff. And Cliff was employed, Cliff was actually relieved of all duties and allocated for 3 months, or is it 6 months? I don't know.